I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The sounds of bombs being dropped on targets in the insurgent stronghold of Fallujah. The Iraqi city U.S. Marines are preparing to invade for the second time in a year. One American Marine says troops are ready.
I think we're prepared for it. I think we're ready to get the job done, whatever we got to do.
Well, joining us on the line is Babouk Degompisha, Baghdad correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He's embedded with the Marines, 3rd Battalion, 1st Regiment, near Fallujah. Babouk, welcome.
Thank you.
I read that Marines are holding drills. They're preparing for landmines, car bombs, house-to-house combat. What's it like where you are?
Well, that's certainly what we're seeing here on the ground. Over the past few days, there's been a lot of movement of vehicles and the Marines themselves, and there's been a lot of drilling, a lot of cleaning and preparation of equipment, and the impression is the big battle is looming. But of course, most of the commanders are a little bit tight-lipped at the moment about a possible start date. It's unclear. They're deferring to the Iraqi interim government and Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, saying that he will have to make the ultimate decision whether the Marines will go into Fallujah.
Yeah. Now, back in April, Marines invaded Fallujah after 4 contracts were killed and hanged. 126 troops were killed there and Ramadi. That ceasefire left insurgents in charge. It's been a no-go zone. The Marines who were involved in that last April invasion have been sent home. How are these new Marines anticipating this?
Well, it seems like the impression is both the soldiers on the ground and the commanders that they absolutely want to avoid, the same resolution that came out of April, which was more or less leaving the town in the hands of the Fallujah Brigade, which was dominated by insurgents. So they really want a very, clearly defined solution to this, which would mean, the U.S. military basically cleaning the town out and, not having a sort of middle road compromise of leaving it in charge of a questionable force.
Well, you have written that insurgents have basically created a reign of terror throughout the country, not just in Fallujah. So why Fallujah and why now?
Well, really, it seems like, it's getting closer and closer to the Iraqi elections. The security situation in the country is, if we can't characterize it as deteriorating, it is certainly not getting any better. And Fallujah, since this April handover that we discussed to this Fallujah Brigade, has really become a rallying point for insurgents. It's it's become a symbol, something they use to sort of snub noses at the U.S. military to say that, they've got this control of this town and made it a no-go area.
Mm. Now, we understand that the combat hospital outside the city has beefed up staff and supplies. They're bracing for up to 60 casualties a day. A Navy commander there says U.S. casualties could reach numbers not seen since Vietnam, and even that hospital has been hit by rockets. It seems obvious, but this is serious stuff.
Definitely, definitely. I don't think anybody has any illusions about the toughness of the battle ahead, and it does seem like they've mentally prepared themselves for that.
Yeah. We understand a team of Iraqi administrators is going to run the city after the invasion. Civil engineers are to move in with a lot of cash, up to $75 million, to try to bring back basic services. But, Babouk, what if this invasion fails?
Well, militarily, I think there's there's little chance that one way or another that the U.S. military will not take over the city. I don't think that's much in dispute. But I suppose it's really the political fallout of this military action that needs to be examined.
And as you've written, it also sets up the prospect of images of a quagmire in Iraq as President Bush has his inauguration day.
Certainly, it has that. There is that possibility, and the fallout from this could be very large. It could spread to other areas of Iraq, possibly in their view in support of what's happening in Fallujah. So again, things do have the potential of getting very messy.
Babouk Degompisha, I know you have seen a lot of combat and a lot of things, but you sound remarkably. Well, perhaps you're just tired, but I'm wondering, how are you feeling about this impending invasion?
Well, I suppose more or less like the Marines on the ground. They just trying to prepare ourselves for it mentally. And again, nobody has any illusions about it being an easy or clean fight. So, just trying to keep our our mind focused on the job at hand.
Boubak Deghampisha, Baghdad correspondent for Newsweek magazine, embedded with the Marines near Fallujah in Iraq. Boubak, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The business world breathed a sigh of relief the day after Election Day because the election wasn't prolonged and because President Bush is considered friendly to the business world. But will the honeymoon be over if the price of oil and the deficit continue to balloon and the value of the dollar declines? Matthew Bishop is business editor at The Economist magazine. He joins us from a studio in London. And Matthew, first of all, which business sectors are likely to benefit most from President Bush's re-election?
I think it's hard to say any particular business sector is going to benefit more than any other, although I guess you would assume the defense sector will continue to be a high priority. I suspect that would have been the same under President Kerry. So I think in general, the benefit is going to be, a positive economic environment in terms of policy, but then difficult challenges from all sorts of things going on in the world out there.
Well, in fact, you mentioned military contractors and the defense industry, and we hear that there's some concern that contractors won't get as much business for weapons because that spending is going to have to be reduced to pay for troops.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the government's budget in America, and that would have been the same whoever won the election. But I suspect that as Mr. Bush looks to make cuts in spending, if indeed that's what he decides to do, that he is less likely to make those cuts in the defense budget, all things being equal.
Yeah. Well, Wall Street is certainly smiling. Wall Street heavily backed the Bush campaign, and it's said to be paying off. Why are they in particular happy?
Well, I think Mr. Bush is going to make a very big priority of tax reform. He's already made a start on that during the first presidency, and now I think, A, the changes that he made are going to stay in place, but also he's going to look at more broad and fundamental tax reform, all of which I think is going to favour, at least initially, the rich and the business world.
Well, and the tax cuts, if they become permanent, and even before they did, they gave Wall Street a lot of money to invest, and now the new plan to privatise Social Security would also be appreciated by Wall Street, correct?
I think the Social Security privatization up to a point benefits Wall Street. Obviously, if that money is invested in shares, that's a good thing. But I think the worry that Wall Street has about Social Security privatization is that for many people, the accounts will be very small and therefore they'll be very expensive to administer. Mm. And so actually there may not be as profitable an opportunity as people are imagining.
Yeah. Let's look at some of the concerns, and you've alluded to them. The U.S. national debt is increasing by $1.67 billion a day. It's currently closing in on the $7.5 trillion mark, and the budget deficit is over $521 billion. I still can't believe these numbers, but what's the feeling in the business world about how that's going to affect the economy in a new Bush administration?
Well, there are two big worries that the business world has. One is that deficit problem. And clearly, if the deficit continues to grow, there will be a lot of worries that people will feel the government is actually sort of causing a damaging effect on the economy, and where will it be able to fund that from? And ultimately, will it have to raise taxes again? So that's a big worry. The other issue that business is worried about is the oil price, which, you know, at current levels they can probably live with, but if it gets much higher than it is now and stays there, then that's really going to be a serious drain on the economy.
Adding millions of dollars in cost to production and just the cost of doing business.
Exactly. I mean, I think America, of all the major economies, uses much more energy for every thing it produces. So if you make a car in Europe, you use much less energy to make it than you do in America. So the American economy is uniquely exposed to the oil price.
How about healthcare? We noticed the stocks of pharmaceutical companies and private health organizations shot up after the Bush reelection. But is he realistically going to be able to help out the industry that's been crying out for help, you know, relief on health care costs, for instance, and credit for innovation? I'm thinking of the auto industry. Is he really going to be able to give them that relief or that tax credit when there's no money to do that?
Well, I think the healthcare sector, particularly the pharmaceuticals companies, are extremely worried that prices will be driven down in America. Now, I suspect that worry is not going to go away because, you know, at the end of the day, there's an aging population, the baby boomers are starting to retire, they need healthcare, they need drugs, and the government's got to pay for them. So the government is going to charge, is going to want to pay a lower price. Now, the thing that the drug companies are right to be pleased about is that Mr. Bush is probably going to go after the trial lawyers who are really sort of making drug companies extremely nervous because, for example, Merck has just withdrawn this drug Vioxx, and people are now talking about losses as a result of lawsuits that may run to $10 or $20 billion. And I think if Mr. Bush does get to grips with the trial lawyers, then there'll be a lot of ease for companies like pharmaceutical giants.
But, of course, not as good news for the victims of those drugs. But that's another segment. Let's just move on to another issue that I found fascinating. We've heard from analysts that the highest drags on the economy and therefore on the business world, higher energy, as we've said, soaring health care costs, as we said, but the manipulation of the currency by China. Explain how that could be a problem for American business and what President Bush might or might not do about that.
Well, the main reason the dollar is as strong as it is at the moment, and it's not very strong compared to what it was, say, 3 or 4 years ago, is that the Chinese are buying up a lot of American Treasury bonds, which means buying a lot of dollars. Now, that, as a result, keeps the Chinese currency quite low, which means that their exports are very competitive to America. Now, at the moment, the Chinese government is resisting pressure to float its currency. If it floated its currency, the Chinese currency would be much more strong against the dollar. The dollar would fall. Chinese goods would be more expensive in America. But really, the Chinese at the moment don't have much demand domestically, so they're relying on American consumers buying all their goods. So the last thing they want at the moment is to raise their currency and make their goods less competitive. So I'm expecting that, in fact, although there's a lot of talk about a revaluation of the China and the Chinese yuan and the dollar, that it won't actually happen.
Mm. Matthew Bishop, business editor at The Economist magazine, speaking to us from The Economist. Matthew, thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we'll turn from business to foreign policy, what's likely to happen there in the president's second term. And later in the program, is it time for Democrats to rethink how they reach out to Catholics? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been looking at the future in a second Bush administration, and now to peer at the tea leaves of foreign policy, we have two guests, Bill Drozdiak. He's executive director of the Transatlantic Center of the German Marshall Fund. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
And Bill, you're based in Brussels, but are speaking to us from New York. And we also have Michael Corrigan. He joins us from Boston. He's professor of international relations at Boston University. Hi, Michael.
Well, hi to you.
And we've been hearing, Michael, let's start with you. We've been hearing that many world leaders want to start over with President Bush. What about the administration? Do we know how they're going to approach what some say is mending fences?
Well, they'll certainly want to mend fences because we are going to need help on Iraq, and the administration has acknowledged that. But keep in mind, this is an administration that's now coming with an even greater mandate than last time. In fact, actually, this time, a mandate of a 3 million-plus edge in the popular vote, a decisive victory in the Electoral College, an increased strength in both houses of Congress. So this is an administration that's not going to have to yield too much. They do want help, and the help is going to start first with the people who have supported the administration. That's Australia, the United Kingdom, and the New Europe in particular. They want to help those people out because those people, those prime ministers and leaders, have been supporting the United States against the wishes, in most cases, of a majority of their own populations.
But, Bill, does the Bush administration perhaps have to yield more because they need help in Iraq?
Well, I think that given the fact that the troops seem to be terribly overstretched and with the demands rising in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq, they'll be looking for help. But I think that the attitude in Europe, particularly in France and Germany, will be at best how to help the United States get out of Iraq. They're going to be very leery about committing their own troops to an occupation that they have criticized from the start.
Well, Michael, are there any quid pro quos that you can think of? Are there any countries that might be itching to sort of strike a deal on some level?
There are. We should keep in mind there's a couple of leaders around the world who are quite happy with this victory. I'd say particularly the Israelis and the Russians are very happy. This allows them to pursue their own ends, and they have been either getting the tacit support of the Bush administration or in some cases, overt support. So they're quite happy with this. They want things to continue as they are. As far as deal-making goes, the United States is going to have to say some of the right things, but I think what's going to happen is that the United States is going to turn up the heat in Iraq. This is going to be more money, I think more casualties, too. But the idea is to get out as soon as possible. This is a tough go for the people who have supported us.
Well, Bill Joziak, what are the biggest questions that some of the world leaders might have, not just about Bush policy, but the Bush administration?
I think the first indications will be in a shakeup of Bush's national security team. I think the attitudes in Europe will be shaped by who he appoints, whether somebody like Colin Powell, who is viewed as a moderate, staunch Atlanticist, stays on at the, as Secretary of State. There are some rumors that he may indeed do so after promising to leave after the first term. And who might succeed Condoleezza Rice as National Security Council and possibly also a successor to Donald Rumsfeld.
Michael, I know you're curious about that question as well, but is there a chance that President Bush might be more conciliatory, as you said, with the backing that he feels he has?
It's not necessary for him to have that, at least domestically. And he has adopted a pretty much go-it-alone policy, actually that predates 9/11, if you look back to some of the earlier actions the United States had taken. I would be interested to see if John McCain thinks he might get some position like that. He's been senator for a while now, and he's been there and done that. If, for instance, President Bush wanted to replace Donald Rumsfeld, it's hard to replace the Secretary of Defense during the course of a war unless you replace him with somebody of equally unimpeachable credentials in terms of prosecuting a war and knowing how that all goes. As I said, I wouldn't be surprised, though, for Colin Powell, if he stays on, he's going to want a price. And that's, I think, the quid pro quos are going to be mostly inside the administration rather than between countries.
Is there a sense that there is someone to replace Colin Powell and be the diplomat that he was, I mean, within the Bush administration?
I don't see anybody immediately on the horizon who would have the qualifications, who is sort of, as Bill said, the Atlanticist and who has a good, clear understanding of all these issues. But that may not be the highest priority for the administration to appoint someone to that position. They may want somebody who might be a little more on the team than Colin Powell has been.
Mm. Bill,
one name I've heard whispered about in Washington when I was down there the last few days is possibly John Danforth, a former senator from Missouri who is now the ambassador to the United Nations. He's somebody very close to President Bush and might be considered a plausible successor. But I agree that John McCain would be viewed very favorably in Europe. He is highly respected there. If he were to replace Donald Rumsfeld, that would be a big boost in terms of personalities that are appreciated in Europe.
And Bill Joziak, a quick thought from you. Are foreign leaders seriously worried that there will be a war in Iran and or Syria?
I think the Iran question is looming as the biggest challenge on the horizon to the transatlantic relationship. The Europeans share the concern in the United States that it's that it would be a terrible development if Iran should acquire nuclear weapons. So I think they're willing to consider UN sanctions as the United States has proposed, but using military force would be something that would really drive a wedge between the United States and its allies.
And Michael Corrigan, how is the U.S. expected to approach North Korea in the new administration?
I think North Korea is a problem. They hope they can simply keep on hold for as long as possible. As Bill has said, and I think we all know, the U.S. forces are really stretched thin around the world. The best we can hope for is that North Korea will try to keep within its own boundaries, and that it won't, Kim Jong-il will not try to take advantage of the situation which he sees and fish in troubled waters, the troubled waters being the drain on U.S. forces worldwide.
Mm. Bill Drozdiak, Executive Director of the Transatlantic Center of the German Marshall Fund. Michael Corrigan teaches international relations at Boston University. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Welcome. Okay, my pleasure.
Next week on Here and Now, that values gap. We'll hear from listeners of all stripes. Also, hear what Republicans plan to do about the 48% of America that went Democrat. And we'll speak to a biographer of Yasser Arafat, learn about the man viewed as a statesman by some, a terrorist by others. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a turnaround from the 1960 presidential election of John Kennedy, the majority of Catholic voters in 2004 did not support the Catholic candidate, Senator John Kerry. Instead, they backed the re-election of President Bush, a Protestant. Religion played an important role in this year's presidential race, but as Here and Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff reports, moral values actually trumped religious affiliation.
Exit polls show President George Bush received 52% of the Catholic vote, while Senator John Kerry got 47%. That's a flip from 2000, when Al Gore carried the Catholic vote. Former Ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn, says these numbers are surprising.
This is amazing, despite the fact that John Kerry is Catholic and George Bush is Protestant.
Kerry only spoke at length about his faith late in the campaign. Bush often talked about his religious beliefs on the campaign trail. Flynn, who traveled to swing states to register Catholic voters, says the exit polls show President Bush's message on moral values resonated among Catholics who attend church regularly.
He increased his popularity among church-going Catholics by 55% to 44%. That's an 11-point increase. Now, ordinarily, people would go to the polls and say, well, you know, I like John Kerry because, you know, his position on the war. This time, that's not how Catholics voted. Catholics went to the polls and they said, I'm not happy at the direction of the moral values of our nation.
Flynn says issues such as gay marriage, stem cell research, and abortion rights drove Catholics to the Republican ticket. John Kenneth White, professor of politics at the Catholic University of America, says Catholic bishops spoke strongly against stem cell research and gay marriage, and many Catholics listened.
Gay marriage, I think, was a very important galvanizing issue for Bush. In one sense, you could argue that Bush had the election won the day the Massachusetts State Supreme Court issued its decision on gay marriage.
Other analysts say Catholics were selective about which moral values they voted on. For instance, the Catholic Church is opposed to the war in Iraq, but for many voters, that took a back seat at the ballot box. David O'Brien, a professor of Catholic Studies at the College of the Holy Cross, says Republicans successfully targeted church-going Catholics.
There was a strategy here in the Republican Party, and working on that strategy were a number of intelligent Catholics who really know the Catholic landscape and were able to craft the language in such a way as to make a real appeal to Catholics in some areas.
Senator Kerry should have emphasized his Catholic faith more, says Michelle Dillon, a professor of the sociology of religion at the University of New Hampshire.
I think John Kerry, as a Catholic, missed an important opportunity not to try to present himself in a more visible way as a Catholic. And, you know, you hear that they don't want to alienate so-called secularists and those who are not religious, but it seems to me that's part of his identity. It's certainly something that he could have made much more of.
Catholics have traditionally voted Democrat, but the past two presidential elections solidify a new trend. Catholics who attend church regularly increasingly vote Republican. Ray Flynn, who is a registered Democrat, says he hopes the Democratic Party realizes it needs a more values-based message to appeal to Catholics.
Maybe, just maybe, after this election, where they saw that they lost so much of the Catholic vote in America, they might decide, from a political point of view, that they cannot win the White House by ignoring the Catholic vote. They just cannot do it.
Others agree the Democratic Party must look closely at how Catholics voted to prepare a new strategy for the next presidential election.
That report from Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff. Well, this year's presidential campaign was also the costliest ever. $1.2 billion was spent attempting to affect the outcome of the race. Overall, federal elections cost 30% more than 4 years ago. Anthony Corrado is with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He's also professor of government at Colby College in Maine. And Professor Corrado, remind us, why was this election so expensive?
Well, partisan competition brings out lots of donors, and one of the things that we saw this year was that, particularly in the presidential race, much higher levels of fundraising than we've seen in the past, in part spurred by hundreds of thousands of individuals who gave money over the internet or gave money through the mail to both the candidates and the parties. As a result, we saw a doubling of the amount of money spent in the presidential race, and we also saw increased fundraising from these new 527 groups, which helped to increase the size of the pot.
Let's talk a little bit about the 527s. They're named after a section of the income tax code. These are the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and MoveOn.org. Senator John McCain and Senator Russ Feingold proposed legislation to bar these groups from raising and spending these unlimited contributions to influence the elections. What does the future hold for them, do you think?
Well, this is clearly going to be one of the issues in the campaign finance debate in the year ahead. We've seen 527s active in elections for some time. They were very active in the 2000 election, spending at least $149 million, and they were very active in 2002. But they really grew this year as a result of about 10 groups that you mentioned, some of them, who are active in the presidential race and have raised and spent over $200 million trying to influence turnout and doing advertising in the presidential election. Most of that money comes from a handful of wealthy donors, and it is now an issue whether these committees, because they are only involved in federal elections, should be registered as federal political committees and subject to campaign finance contribution limits. Right. And that's what McCain and Feingold are now proposing.
Well, then there are the individual contributors. There's George Soros for the Democrats, Bob J. Perry for the Republicans. They've contributed millions of dollars this year. Overall, there's been an increase of $1 billion in individual contributions. Who are some of the others that made these contributions, and what's the thinking about that?
Well, with respect to the 527s, what you find is that it was really a small group of millionaires who gave a large share of the money. There were about 10 donors who gave over $80 million. In terms of the increase in individual contributions, one of the biggest things we have seen is a growth in the number of small donors. Both of the major parties have added hundreds of thousands of new small donors to their party donor rolls. And in the presidential race, we had $132 million more in money that came from small donors, much of it over the internet. So that as a result, part of the increase in giving is a result of an increase in participation that was driven by the high stakes in this election.
Some have said that the takeaway headline from the elections is that the candidate who spends the most money wins. What do you see happening 4 years down the road? Another 30% increase?
I don't think we'll see another 30% increase, but I expect that we will see an additional increase, in large part because there's so much at stake right now in terms of the partisan divide in the country, and because so much money can be leveraged into such a small number of states in a small number of congressional races that it really creates almost an arms race of spending.
Professor, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Anthony Corrado is with the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and professor in the Department of Government at Colby College in Maine. Still to come, the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest stories ever told. It still resonates today. You're listening to Here and Now. Scientists say they have evidence which supports a key element of Einstein's general theory of relativity. They've measured tiny variations in satellite orbits, and they claim these variations are the first physical proof of an effect known as frame dragging. Professor Erikos Pavlis of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, is one of two scientists who revealed the discovery in a recent edition of the journal Nature. Welcome, Erikos, and tell us, what is frame dragging?
Hello. Frame dragging is the effect that a rotating massive body has in space and time in its vicinity. And in addition to the fact that space and time are curved by the existence of a massive body, as was predicted by Albert Einstein in the theory of general relativity, we have also an additional effect when we put this massive body in a rotation, and it's the spin that actually causes this additional distortion, deformation of the space and time near.
Well, let's say that Earth is the rotating body.
That's exactly what we tested.
Mm-hmm. How does it have frame dragging? How do you see it causing frame dragging?
Okay. Let's think of the Earth being like a bowling ball that we drop in molasses and we try to spin it. To begin with, once we drop it, then we see molasses deforming as the heavy body drops in them. If you try to, in addition, spin it, then you see the thick molasses twisting around the ball as it drags them. In the same sense, you get satellites, two tiny satellites that they orbit 6,000 kilometers above the surface of Earth in very stable or otherwise orbits. You see those orbits being dragged by this mm-hmm. massive body that spins under them.
Like the molasses.
Exactly.
Well, you have molasses and bowling balls and satellites, which you tracked over a long period of time. 10 years, do I read?
About 11 years,
well,
yes.
Yeah. What did Einstein have? How did he know this?
Well, actually, Einstein did not know this. He wrote down equations and he wrote his theory, which was later taken apart by other scientists in trying to understand what exactly was that he was saying. So Lenze and Thiering, Austrian physicists, in 1918, they basically came up with this prediction saying that the equations that Einstein wrote down, they basically predict that this effect should exist. Mm-hmm. Now, there was nothing as accurate at that time, and probably for, let's say, many, many years later, that could actually detect this this effect.
I just want to ask you one last personal question. Having spent 11 years with this research, Einstein had a famous quote. He said, if my theory of relativity is proven successful, Germany will claim me as a German, France will declare that I am a citizen of the world. Should my theory prove untrue, France will say I am a German, and Germany will declare that I am a Jew. Of course, we know that Einstein fled Nazi
yes.
Germany. You lived with this man in a way for 11 years testing his theory. Your thoughts on him, on his thinking, especially as you were proving him right?
Well, I think it has been the greatest mind of the previous century, as was declared some years ago. And I feel that, you know, what we've done is a very tiny thing. I mean, nowhere near, you know, what he accomplished by writing down a few equations, basically. And I think that it proves that one person can make a big, big difference for all mankind. And, of course, it doesn't matter whether he comes from this side, that side, or the other, or whatever, you know, country.
Erikos, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Professor Pavlis is a researcher at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Long before Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, the King Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu set out in Uruk, now Iraq, on a journey of dragon slaying and self-discovery. In fact, their story was told over 5,000 years ago, 1,000 years before the Bible. And now Gilgamesh has a new retelling from acclaimed poet and translator Stephen Mitchell.
He had seen everything, had experienced all emotions, from exaltation to despair, had been granted a vision into the great mystery, the secret places, the primeval days before the flood. He had journeyed to the edge of the world and made his way back, exhausted but whole.
Gilgamesh was written on baked clay tablets in Assyria, in what is now Iraq, 5,000 years ago. It's a tale that foreshadows Homer's Odyssey, the Hebrews' Noah, and, according to Stephen Mitchell, current events in Iraq. His new book is called Gilgamesh, A New English Version, and Stephen joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Remind us of the story of Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu, is that how you say
Enkidu,
it?
Enkidu, yes. And it's about a king who's a gigantic, powerful presence who becomes a tyrant.
Gilgamesh the king, his friend Enkidu, a naked wild man civilized through the erotic arts of a temple priestess.
That's a marvelous episode. It's so deeply moving and interesting to encounter a culture which has eros at its center and in a totally positive way. It sees making love as a civilizing virtue. The rest of the book is about friendship and arrogance and preemptive attacks and the unforeseen consequences, and then about death and grief and how that grief leads Gilgamesh into a quest for immortality and ultimately wisdom.
Yeah. Gilgamesh and Enkidu set off on the mother of all heroic journeys. They're going to attack the monster Humbaba in the cedar forest, and you say that's the original preemptive attack.
Well, it is. Gilgamesh decides to attack the monster for no discernible reason except that he wants to win fame, and for the best of motives, he wants to rid the world of evil. The monster has been put in his position by the gods, and his job is to terrify human beings away from the cedar forest. The gods don't want human
right.
beings cutting down the great cedars.
It's the original ecological balance.
It is, and we could use a few monsters in our national forests, I think. There's a lot of sympathy for the monster. And after he's killed, the consequences are that that Gilgamesh's dear, intimate friend and lover, Enkidu, has to pay the price and has
lover?
To die.
Is this a...
Well, this is the first and probably the only great masterpiece that includes gay marriage. It's the great example in our cultural heritage of a lasting sexual relationship between two men. This, you have to understand, is 1,000 years before David and Jonathan in the Bible, and Achilles and Patroclus in the Iliad.
Well, you have just brought up a whole bunch of things, and I'm wondering, you know, for people who are saying, wow, I read Gilgamesh in 10th grade and I don't remember any of that. Is this something you're seeing in the translations? Is this
No, it's explicit. When Enkidu dies, he mourns him as a bride, and he sets out on a journey to try to find a way to avoid death. He's heard that his ancestor, has been granted immortality by the gods. Ultimately, Gilgamesh travels to the ends of the world and goes through some wonderful adventures, and finally meets this man who recounts the story of the Great Flood and basically says, this was a one-time deal and it's too bad it's not available to you. And Gilgamesh has to deal with that. And in dealing with that and seeing that the quest for wisdom has its own, is deconstructed in the doing, he arrives at a mature kind of wisdom.
So we shouldn't be saying someone goes on a Homeric journey. We should be saying they go on a
Gilgameshian
journey. Stephen Mitchell, you've said you see comparisons to modern-day Iraq. Do you worry about bringing your modern-day sensibilities to something so ancient?
I don't. I don't know Akkadian, which is a form of ancient Babylonian. So I worked with half a dozen literal scholarly translations into English and then a number of others into German and French, and did all my homework, read all the scholarship, and there's some excellent scholarship, and then put together a literal version. And that was about 10% of my work. The other 90% was taking that basic literal version and raising it to the level of a verse in English and finding a music that seemed genuine and as exciting and powerful as the story itself is. The story is riveting in any version. You can read it in a child's version and see the power of it. But I had felt in reading many, many translations that the language had never matched the excitement and power of the story, and that's why I began to do it myself. You have to be a bit blind and deaf if you're writing in 2004 about a masterpiece that comes from ancient Iraq, for goodness sake, and is about somebody going out to kill a monster, for goodness sake, not to see the parallel. So right. I think it would have been silly for me not to point them out. They exist.
What do you make of that, that they do exist?
Well, I think that when a writer is writing from the depth that any writer of a masterpiece is necessarily writing from, they're tapping into a level of human experience and wisdom that makes the masterpiece relevant for any age.
And in the final analysis, Gilgamesh could not have become the good man he became if he hadn't gone to foolishly and arrogantly attack the dragon that wasn't harming him. And if he hadn't lost his best friend.
That's true, and it takes a good deal of humility and grief to come to that wisdom. If you're not aware that you've made a grave mistake, then the path is not to wisdom but to further disasters.
Poet Stephen Mitchell, author of Gilgamesh, A New English Version, will leave you with the end of the prologue, inviting the reader in to the city where Gilgamesh lived and to one of the greatest stories ever told.
Walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course around the city, inspect its mighty foundations, examine its brickwork, how masterfully it is built. Observe the land it encloses, the palm trees, the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares. Find the cornerstone, and under it the copper box that is marked with his name. Unlock it. Open the lid. Take out the tablet of lapis lazuli. Read how Gilgamesh suffered all and accomplished all.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer, Lindsay Crudell. Our interns, John McAvoy and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.